her beatifically, like a saint's smile on a stained glass window. He regarded the watches on his wrist, then pointed the electric bullhorn toward the front and blared, "Let the straitjacket game start now!" 5 minutes, friend Josh. Swan flinched and waited for what would be. Chapter 42. Josh jumped at the sound of the bullhorn. Before he could take one stride forward, an arm clamped around his neck from behind and started squeezing. It was old Blackbeard, he realized. Bastards trying to nail me right off. Instinctively, Josh threw his head backward in what was known as a reverse coconut butt in the ring, but this time he let it go full throttle. His skull smacked into Blackbeard's forehead, and suddenly the restraining arm was gone. Josh spun around to finish the job and found Blackbeard sitting on his ass, his eyes glazed and his forehead already purpling. The other lunatic swung the shotgun up. "Go," he ordered, and he grinned with green teeth. Josh had no time to waste. He turned and started running full bore along the center aisle. He'd taken 6 long strides when a baseball bat swung out along the floor and clipped his right ankle. He fell, hit the floor on his belly, and slid another 8 feet across the linoleum. Instantly, he twisted to face his attacker, who'd been hiding behind a counter of socks and underwear. The man, who wore a red football helmet, rose up and rushed Josh, swinging the bat for a game-ending home run. Josh drew his knees to his chest, kicked out and up, and caught the maniac right in the stomach with both feet, lifting him about 4 feet in the air. The man came down on his tailbone, and Josh scrambled up to kick him in the groin as if he were making a 50-yard field goal. As the man contorted into a shivering ball, Josh got his left hand around the bat and snatched it up. He worked his grip down to the handle, and though he had no real leverage, at least he had a weapon. He turned to continue along the aisle and faced a skinny dude with an axe and another bastard with a blue-painted face who was carrying a sledgehammer. No way, Josh thought. And he darted along one of the other aisles, intending to swing toward the pet department from a different angle. He skidded into a female mannequin, and the brown-haired head tumbled off the shoulders to the floor.
4 minutes, friend Josh,
Lord Alvin's voice announced. A figure with an upraised butcher knife burst from amid a rack of dresses in Josh's path. Can't stop, Josh knew, unable to lock his knees in time. Instead, he plowed forward, threw himself off his feet in a body block that slammed into the knife wielder and drove him into the dress rack, which collapsed around them. The man struck with a knife, missed, struck again, and snagged the blade in fabric. Josh got astride his chest and brought the bat's shaft down on the man's skull, once, twice, and a third time. The body quivered as if plugged into an electric socket. A stabbing pain hit Josh in the neck. He looked around and saw a dungareed, leering maniac holding a fishing rod. The line was taut between them, and Josh knew there was a hook in his skin. The lunatic fisherman wrenched on the rod as if he were landing a prize marlin, and the hook ripped out of Josh's neck. The rod was snapped again, the hook flashing toward Josh's face. But he ducked it and scrabbled out of the dresses, regaining his feet and running for the pet department again.
3 minutes left, friend Josh.
No, Josh thought, no. The bastard was cheating. Another minute couldn't have passed yet. He sprinted past a well-dressed mannequin in the men's department, but suddenly the mannequin came to life and leapt on his back, fingers clawing at his eyes. He kept running as the man held on, the jagged fingernails carving Josh's cheeks, and ahead of him stood a lean, bare-chested black man with a screwdriver in one hand and a garbage can lid in the other. Josh ran full steam at the waiting assassin, then abruptly stopped, sliding across the floor. He hunched over and spun his shoulders. The man on his back lost his grip and hurtled through the air. But Josh's aim was off. Instead of crashing into the black man, as Josh had hoped, the well-dressed lunatic sailed over a counter full of summer shirts and hit the floor. The black man attacked, moving like a panther. Josh swung the bat, but the garbage can lid was there to deflect it. The screwdriver drove in at Josh's stomach. He twisted away, and the weapon grazed his ribs. They fought at close quarters, Josh desperately avoiding the thrusts of the screwdriver and trying vainly to get a good strike with his bat. As they grappled, Josh caught movement on both sides. More of them, coming in for the kill. He knew he was finished if he couldn't get away from this crazy bro, because a husky man with garden shears was almost upon him. The black man's teeth snapped at Josh's cheek. Josh saw his opening and dropped to his knees, scooting between the man's legs like a greased pig. When the bro whirled around, he was met by a blow that crumpled his face and knocked teeth through the air. He took two wobbly steps and fell like a tree. Josh kept going, his breath wheezing in his lungs. 2 minutes, Lord Alvin crowed. Faster, Josh urged himself. Faster, damn it. The pet department was still so far away, and the son of a bitch was rushing time. Protect the child, got to protect. A maniac with a white powdered face rose up from behind a counter and slammed a tire iron across Josh's left shoulder. Josh cried out in pain and tumbled into a display of Quaker State oil cans, agony shooting from his shoulder to his fingertips. He'd lost the baseball bat. It was rolling across the aisle, way out of reach. The white-faced madman attacked him, flailing wildly with the tire iron while Josh fought in a frenzy. The tire iron smashed down beside Josh's head and burst one of the cans open. And then they were fighting like two animals, kill or be killed. Josh caught the man in the ribs with a knee and drove him back, but he leapt in again. They rolled in motor oil across the floor, Josh's opponent squirming like an eel. And then the man was up on his feet. He charged Josh, the tire iron upraised for a blow to the skull. But his shoes slipped out from under him in the oil, and he crashed to the floor on his back. At once, Josh got astride him, one knee trapping the tire iron and the other knee pressed to the man's throat. He lifted both hands and heard himself bellow with fury as he brought the chain down, at the same time putting all his weight on the throat. He felt his knee break through something soft, and the scarlet imprint of the chain was left on the distorted face like a tattoo. Josh struggled to his feet, his lungs heaving, his shoulder pounded with excruciating pain, but he couldn't give in to it. Keep going, he told himself. Move, you fool! A hammer sailed past him, clattering into a display of hubcaps. He slipped, fell to his knees. Blood was in his mouth and crawling down his face, and the seconds were ticking. He thought of the roach on the barn floor, the survivor of insecticides and stomping boots in a nuclear holocaust. If such a thing as that had the will to live, then he damned well did too. Josh stood up. He ran along the aisle, saw three more figures coming toward him. He jumped over a counter into another aisle, a left turn and a clear aisle lined with housewares, pots and pans stretched before him. And way down at the end of it sat Lord Alvin, watching from his throne. On the wall behind him was the sign Pets. Josh could see the dwarf jumping up and down in the shopping cart, and Swan's face was turned toward him. Crybaby lay so close but so far away. 1 minute, Lord Alvin announced through the bullhorn. I've made it, Josh realized. Dear God, I'm almost there. It can't be more than 40 feet to the dowsing rod. He started forward, but he heard the low growl and the rising whine, and the Neanderthal with a chainsaw stepped into the aisle to block his way. Josh stopped with a jolt. The Neanderthal, his bald head shining under the lights, smiled faintly and waited for him, the chainsaw's teeth a blur of deadly metal. Josh looked around for some other way to go. The housewares aisle was an unbroken sweep of kitchen items, glasses and crockery, except for an aisle that turned to the right about 10 feet away. And three maniacs guarded that portal, all armed with knives and garden tools. He turned to retrace his path, and about 5 yards away stood the madman with the fishing rod and the green-toothed lunatic with the shotgun. He saw more of them coming, taking positions to watch the finale of the straitjacket game. The ass is grass, Josh knew, but not just his. Swan and Leona were dead if he didn't reach the finish line. There was no way except through the Neanderthal. 40 seconds, friend Josh! The Neanderthal swiped at the air with the chainsaw, daring Josh to come on. Josh was almost used up. The Neanderthal handled that chainsaw with childish ease. Had they come all this way to die in a damned Kmart full of escaped fruitcakes? Josh didn't know whether to laugh or cry, so he just said, "Shit." Well, he decided if they were going to die, he was going to do his best to take the Neanderthal with him. And Josh stood to his full height, swelled out his chest, and let loose a roaring laugh. The Neanderthal grinned, too. 30 seconds, Lord Alvin said. Josh threw his head back, released a war whoop at the top of his lungs, and then he charged like a runaway Mack truck. The Neanderthal stood his ground, braced his legs, and swung the chainsaw. But Josh suddenly juked back out of range, the chainsaw's breeze brushing his face as it swept past. The other man's rib cage was an open target. And before the Neanderthal could bring the chainsaw back around, Josh kicked those ribs like he was aiming at next week. The man's face scrunched up with pain, and he went back a few feet, but didn't go down. Then he was balanced again, and now he was rushing forward and the chainsaw was coming at Josh's head. Josh had no time to think, just to act. He flung his arms up in front of his face. The saw's teeth hit the chains around his wrists, shooting sparks. The vibration sent Josh and the Neanderthal reeling in opposite directions, but still neither one fell. 20 seconds, the bullhorn blared. Josh's heart was hammering, but he was strangely calm. It was reach the finish line or not, and that was it. He crouched and warily advanced, hoping to trip the other man up somehow. And then the Neanderthal sprang forward, faster than Josh had expected the big man to move, and the chainsaw slashed at Josh's skull. Josh started to leap back, but the chainsaw strike was a feint. The Neanderthal's booted right foot came up and caught Josh in the stomach, knocking him along the aisle. He crashed into the counter of pots and pans and kitchen tools, clattering around him in a shower of metal. "Roll!" Josh screamed mentally, and as he whipped aside, the Neanderthal brought the chainsaw down where he'd been lying, carving a foot-long trench across the floor. Quickly, Josh twisted back to the other side and kicked upward, hitting the opponent just under the jawbone. The Neanderthal was lifted off his feet, and then he, too, crashed into the houseware's display. But he kept tight hold of the saw and started getting to his feet as blood dribbled from both corners of his mouth. The audience hooted and clapped. 10 seconds! Josh was on his knees before he realized what was scattered around him. Not only pots and pans, but an array of carving knives. One with a blade about 8 inches long lay right in front of him. He put his left hand around its grip and forced the fingers shut with sheer willpower, and the knife was his. The Neanderthal, his eyes clouded with pain, spat out teeth and what might have been part of his tongue. Josh was on his feet. "Come on," he shouted, fainting with the knife. "Come on, you crazy asshole." The other man obliged him. He began stalking down the aisle toward Josh, sweeping the chainsaw back and forth in a deadly arc. Josh kept moving backward. He glanced quickly over his shoulder, saw the mad fisherman and the shotgun wielder about 5 feet behind him. In a fraction of a second, he realized that Green Teeth was holding his shotgun in a loose, casual grip. The ring of keys dangled at the man's belt. The Neanderthal was advancing steadily, and when he grinned, blood drooled out. "You're going the wrong way, friend Josh," Lord Alvin said. "It doesn't matter anyway. Time's up." "Come on,"
and take your pill. Kiss my ass, Josh shouted, and then he whirled around in a blur of motion and drove the blade up to the hilt in Green Teeth's chest just above the heart. As the madman's mouth opened in a shriek, Josh clamped his left hand around the shotgun's trigger guard, wrenching the weapon loose. The man fell to the floor in a spray of arterial blood. The Neanderthal charged. Josh turned in what seemed like nightmarish slow motion. He fought to hold the shotgun steady, trying to get his finger on the trigger. The Neanderthal was almost on him, and the saw was coming up for a vicious, side-swiping slash. Josh braced the butt of the shotgun against his chest, felt the awful breeze of the chainsaw. His finger found the trigger, and he squeezed. The Neanderthal was within 3 feet, the chainsaw about to bite flesh, but in the next instant, a fist-sized hole opened in his stomach and half his back flew out. The force of the blast shook Josh and almost knocked the Neanderthal out of his boots. The chainsaw flashed past Josh's face, its weight spinning the dead man like a top along the bloody floored aisle.
"No fair!" Lord Alvin shouted, jumping up from his throne. "You didn't play right!"
The corpse hit the floor, still gripping the chainsaw, and the metal teeth chewed a circle in the linoleum. Josh saw Lord Alvin throw aside the bullhorn and reach into his robes. The madman's hand emerged with an extra gleaming finger, a crescent-bladed hunting knife like a miniature scythe. Lord Alvin turned upon Swan and Leona. With the shotgun's blast, the other psychos had fled for cover. Josh had one shell left, and he couldn't afford to waste it. He sprinted forward, leaped over the jittering body, and barreled for the pet department where Lord Alvin, his face contorted with a mixture of rage and what might have been pity, knelt before Swan and grasped the back of her neck with his free hand.
"Death! Death!" Imp shrieked.
Swan looked up into Lord Alvin's face and knew she was about to die. Tears burned her eyes, but she lifted her chin defiantly.
"Time to go to sleep,"
Lord Alvin whispered. He lifted the crescent blade. Josh slipped on the bloody floor and went down, skidding into a counter 6 feet short of the dowsing rod. He scrambled to get up, but he knew that he'd never make it. Lord Alvin smiled, two tears rolling from his murky green eyes. The crescent blade was poised, about to fall.
"Sleep," he said.
But a small gray form had already streaked out from behind sacks of dog food and kitty litter, and, growling like a hound from hell, it leaped toward Lord Alvin's face. The terrier snapped his teeth around Alvin Mangrim's thin and delicate nose, crunched through flesh and cartilage, and snapped the man's head back. Lord Alvin fell on his side, writhing and screaming, frantically trying to push the animal away, but the terrier kept hold. Josh jumped over Crybaby, saw Swan and Leona still alive, saw the terrier gnawing on Lord Alvin's nose and the madman flailing with his hunting knife. Josh aimed the shotgun at Lord Alvin's skull, but he didn't want to hit the dog, and he knew he'd need that shell. The terrier suddenly freed Lord Alvin and scrambled back with bloody flesh between his teeth, then planted his paws and let out a fusillade of barks. Lord Alvin sat up, what remained of his nose hanging from his face and his eyes wide with shock, shrieking,
"Blasphemy! Blasphemy!"
He bolted to his feet and ran, still screaming, out of the pet department. Nearby, Imp was the last of Lord Alvin's subjects left in the vicinity. The dwarf was hissing curses at Josh, who lunged over to the shopping cart, spun it around, and sent it flying down the aisle. Imp bailed out a few seconds before it crashed into fish tanks and upended. Alvin Mangrim had left his knife behind, and Josh spent a couple of anxious minutes cutting the ropes loose from Swan and Leona. When Swan's hands were freed, she put her arms around Josh's neck and held tight,
her body shaking like a tough sapling in a tornado. The terrier came close enough for Josh to touch and sat back on its haunches, its muzzle scarlet with Lord Alvin's blood. For the first time, Josh saw that the dog was wearing a flea collar, and on it was a little metal name tag that said, Killer. Josh knelt over Leona and shook her. The woman's eyelids fluttered, her face slack, a terrible purple swelling around the gash over her left eye. Concussion, Josh realized, or worse. She lifted a hand to touch the smeared grease paint on Josh's face, and then her eyes opened. She smiled weakly. You done good, she said. He helped her up. They had to get out fast. Josh braced the shotgun against his belly and started along the aisle where the Neanderthal lay. Swan retrieved the dowsing rod, grasped Leona's hand, and pulled her forward like a sleepwalker. Still barking, Killer darted ahead. Josh came to Green Teeth's body and took the ring of keys. He'd worry later about which key unlocked his wrist chains. Right now, they had to get out of this asylum before Lord Alvin rallied the maniacs. They sensed furtive movements on both sides of the aisle as they continued through the Kmart, but Lord Alvin's subjects had no initiative of their own. Someone threw a shoe, and a red rubber ball came bouncing at them. But otherwise, they made the front doors without incident. Cold rain was still pouring down, and within seconds, they were drenched. The parking lot lamps cast harsh yellow halos over the abandoned cars. Josh felt the weight of exhaustion creeping up on him. They found their wheelbarrow overturned, their supplies either stolen or scattered. Their bags and belongings were gone, including Swan's Cookie Monster doll. Swan looked down and saw a few of Leona's tarot cards lying on the wet pavement, along with broken shards of her crystal ball collection. Lord Alvin's subjects had left them nothing but the soaked clothes sticking to their bodies. Swan glanced back toward the Kmart and felt horror like a cold hand placed to a burn. They were coming out the doors, 10 or 11 figures, led by one in a purple robe that blew around his shoulders. Some of them were carrying rifles. Josh! She shouted. He kept walking about 10 feet ahead. He hadn't heard her for the storm. Josh! She shouted again, and then she sprinted the distance between them and whacked him across the back with Crybaby. He spun around, eyes stricken, and then he saw them coming too. They were 30 yards away, zigzagging between the cars. There was a flash of gunfire, and the rear windshield of a Toyota van behind Josh exploded. Get down! He yelled, shoving Swan to the pavement. He grabbed Leona as more pinpoints of fire sparkled. Another car's windshield blew out. But by then, Josh, Swan, and Leona were huddled in the shelter of a blue Buick with 2 flat tires. Bullets ricocheted and glass showered around them. Josh crouched, waiting for the bastards to come closer before he reared up and fired the last shell. A hand grasped the shotgun's barrel. Leona's face was drawn and weary, but the heat of life shone in her eyes. She gripped the shotgun firmly, trying to pull it away from him. He resisted, shaking his head. Then he saw the blood that trickled from a corner of Leona's mouth. He looked down. The bullet wound was just below her heart. Leona smiled wanly, and Josh could just make out what she said from the movement of her lips. Go. She nodded toward the far expanse of the rain-swept parking lot. Now, she told him. He'd already seen how much blood she was losing. She knew, too. It was in her face. She wouldn't let go of the shotgun, and she spoke again. Josh couldn't hear her, but he thought it might have been, protect the child. The rain was streaming down Josh's face. There was so much to say, so much. But neither of them could hear the other over the voice of the storm. And words were flimsy. Josh glanced at Swan, saw that she'd seen the wound, too. Swan lifted her gaze to Leona's, then to Josh's, and she knew what had been decided.
"No," she shouted, "I won't let you."
She grabbed Leona's arm. A gunshot blasted the side window of a pickup truck nearby. More bullets hit the truck's door, blew out the front tire, and whined off the wheel. Josh looked into the woman's eyes. He released the shotgun. She pulled it to her and put her finger on the trigger, then motioned for them to go. Swan clung to her. Leona grasped Crybaby and pushed the dowsing rod firmly against Swan's chest, then deliberately pulled her arm free from Swan's fingers. The decision was made. Now Leona's eyes were clouding, the flow of blood fast and fatal. Josh kissed her cheek, hugged her tight to him for a few seconds, and then he mouthed the words, "Follow me," to Swan, and started off in a half-crawl, half-crouch between the cars. He couldn't bear to look at Leona again, but he would remember every line in her face until the day he died. Leona ran the fingers of one hand over Swan's cheek and smiled, as if she'd seen the child's inside face, and held it like a cameo in her heart. Then Swan saw the woman's eyes go hard, preparing for what was ahead. There was nothing more. Swan lingered as long as she dared before she followed Josh into the maze of vehicles. Leona rose to a crouch. The pain below her heart was an irritating sting compared to her rheumatic knees. She waited, the rain pounding down on her, and she was not afraid. It was time to fly from this body now, time to see clearly what she'd only beheld through a dark glass. She waited a moment longer, and then she stood up and stepped out from behind the Buick, facing the Kmart like a gunfighter at the OK Corral. Four of them were standing about 6 feet away, and behind them were two others. She didn't have time to make sure the one in the purple robe was there. She aimed the shotgun in their midst and pulled the trigger, even as two of the madmen fired their guns at her. Josh and Swan broke from the cover of the cars and ran across the open lot. Swan almost looked back, almost, but didn't. Josh staggered, the exhaustion about to drive him down. Off to the side, the terrier kept pace with them, looking like a drowned rat. Swan wiped rain from her eyes. There was motion ahead. Something was coming through the storm. Josh had seen it too, couldn't tell what it was, but if the lunatics had circled around them, they were finished. The piebald horse broke from a sweeping curtain of rain, charging toward them, but it didn't appear to be the same animal. This horse looked stronger, somehow more valiant, with a straighter back and courage in its forward thrust neck. Josh and Swan both could have sworn they saw mule's hooves striking showers of sparks off the pavement. The horse careened to a stop in front of them, reared and pawed at the air. When the animal came down again, Josh grabbed Swan's arm by his free hand and flung her up onto Mule. He wasn't sure what he was more scared of, riding the horse or facing the madmen, but when he dared to look around, he saw figures running through the rain, and he made up his mind right quick. He swung up behind Swan and kicked Mule's ribs with both heels. The horse reared again, and Josh saw the pursuing figures abruptly stop. The one in the lead wore purple, had long, wet blonde hair and a mangled nose. Josh had a second to lock stares with Lord Alvin, the hatred flaming through his bones, and he thought, "Someday, you son of a bitch, someday you'll pay." Gunfire leapt. Mule whirled around and raced out of the parking lot as if he were going for the roses in the Kentucky Derby. Killer followed behind, plowing through the storm. Swan gripped hold of Mule's mane to guide him, but the horse was deciding their direction. They sped away from the Kmart, away from the dead town of Matheson, through the rain along a highway that stretched into darkness. But in the last of the light from the lunatic Kmart, they saw a roadside sign that read, "Welcome to Nebraska, the Cornhusker State." They passed it in a blur, and Swan wasn't sure what it had said. The wind blew into her face, and she held Crybaby in one hand and Mule's mane with the other. And they seemed to be cleaving a fiery path through the dark and leaving a sea of sparks in their wake.
"I don't think we're in Kansas anymore," Swan shouted.
"Damn straight," Josh answered.
They raced into the storm, heading toward a new horizon. And a couple of minutes after they'd passed, the terrier came bounding after them. Chapter 43. A wolf with yellow eyes darted in front of the pickup truck. Paul Thorson instinctively hit the brake, and the truck slewed violently to the right, narrowly missing the burned wreckage of a tractor-trailer rig and a Mercedes-Benz in the middle of I-80's westbound lanes before the worn tires gripped pavement again. The truck's engine racketed and snorted like an old man having a bad dream. In the passenger seat, Steve Buchanan stuck the Magnum's barrel through the slit of his rolled-down window and took aim, but before he could fire, the animal had vanished into the woods again.
"Jesus H. Christ," Steve said. "Those fuckers are coming out of the woodwork now. This is a suicide mission, man."
Another wolf ran in front of the truck, taunting them. Paul could have sworn the bastard smiled. His own face was set like stone as he concentrated on weaving a path through the wreckage, but inside he was lanced by icy fear of a kind he'd never known. There wouldn't be enough bullets to hold off the wolves when the time came. The people in the truck would look to him for help, but he would fail them. "I'm afraid. Oh, dear God. I'm afraid." He picked up the bottle of Johnny Walker Red that sat between himself and the teenager, uncapped it with his teeth, and took a swig that made his eyes water. He handed it to Steve, who drank some courage of his own. For perhaps the 100th time in the last 5 minutes, Paul glanced at the gas gauge. The needle was about 3 hairs shy of the big red E. They'd passed 2 gas stations in the last 15 miles, and Paul's worst nightmares were coming true. One of the stations had been razed to the ground, and the other had a sign that said, "No gas, no guns, no money, no nothing." The pickup labored west under a leaden sky. The highway was a junkyard of wrecked hulks and frozen wolf-gnawed corpses. Paul had seen a dozen or so wolves trailing them, waiting for us to start walking, he knew. They can smell that tank drying up. Damn it to hell. Why did we leave the cabin? We were safe. We could have stayed there. Forever? He wondered. A gust of wind hit the pickup broadside and the vehicle shuddered right down to its slick treads. Paul's knuckles turned white as he fought the wheel. The kerosene had run out a day earlier, and the day before that, Artie Wisco had begun coughing up blood. The cabin was 20 miles behind them now. They'd passed a point of no return, everything around them desolate and as gray as Undertaker's fingers. "I should never have listened to that crazy woman," he thought, taking the bottle from Steve. "She'll get us all killed yet." "Suicide mission, man," Steve repeated. A crooked grin carved across his burn-scarred face. Sister sat beside Artie in the rear of the truck, both of them protected from the wind by a blanket. She was holding on to Paul's rifle. He taught her how to load and fire it, and had told her to blow hell out of any wolves that got too close. The 15 or so that were following slipped back and forth between the wreckage, and Sister decided not to waste bullets. Nearby, also covered by a blanket, were the Ramseys and the old man who'd forgotten his name. The old man clutched the shortwave radio, though the batteries had died days ago. Over the engine's racket, Sister could hear Artie's agonized breathing. He held his side, blood flecking his lips, his face contorted with pain. The only chance for him was to find medical help of some kind, and Sister had come too far with him to let him die without a struggle. Sister had one arm around the duffel bag. The previous night, she'd looked into the shining jewels of the glass circle and seen another strange image. What appeared to be a roadside sign at night, dimly illuminated by a distant glow that read, Welcome to Matheson, Kansas. We're strong, proud, and growing. She'd had the impression of dreamwalking along a highway that led toward a light, reflected off the bellies of low clouds. There were figures around her, but she couldn't quite make out who they were. Then, abruptly, she lost her grip on the vision, and she was back in the cabin, sitting in front of a dying fire. She'd never heard of Matheson, Kansas before, if there was really such a place. Looking into the depths of the glass ring caused the imagination to boil like soup in a stock pot. And why should what bubbled out of it have any connection with reality? But what if there was a Matheson, Kansas, she'd asked herself. Would that mean her visions of a desert where a Cookie Monster doll lay and of a table where fortune-telling cards were arranged were also real places? No, of course not. Yeah, I used to be crazy, but I'm not crazy anymore, she'd thought. It was all imagination, all wisps of fantasy that the colors of the glass circle created in her mind. I want it, the thing in its Doyle Halland disguise had said back in that bloody room in New Jersey. I want it. And I have it, sister thought. Me, of all possible people. Why me? She answered her own question. Because when I want to hold on to something, even the devil himself can't pry it loose, that's why.
Gone to Detroit, Artie said.
He was smiling, his eyes bright with fever.
About time I got home, don't you think?
You're going to be all right,
she took his hand. The flesh was wet and hot.
We're going to find some medicine for you.
Oh, she's gonna be so mad at me, he continued. I was supposed to call her that night. I went out with the boys. Supposed to call her. Let her down.
No, you didn't. It's all right. You just be quiet and...
Mona Ramsey screamed. Sister looked up. A yellow-eyed wolf the size of a Doberman had scrambled up on the rear bumper and was trying to hitch itself over the tailgate. The animal's jaws snapped wantonly at the air. Sister had no time to aim or fire. She just clubbed the beast's skull with a rifle barrel, and the wolf yelped and dropped back to the highway. It was gone into the woods before Sister could get her finger on the trigger. Four others, who'd been shadowing the truck, scattered for cover. Mona Ramsey was babbling hysterically.
Hush, Sister demanded.
The young woman stopped her jabbering and gaped at her.
You're making me nervous, dear, Sister said. I get very cranky when I'm nervous.
The pickup swerved over ice, its right side scraping along the wreckage of a six-car pileup before Paul could regain control. He threaded a passageway between wrecks, but the highway ahead was an auto graveyard. More animals skulked at the edges of the road, watching the pickup rumble past. The gas gauge's needle touched E.
We're running on fumes, Paul said, and he wondered how far they could get on the Johnny Walker Red.
Hey, look there, Steve Buchanan pointed.
To the right, over the leafless trees, was a tall Shell gas station sign. They rounded a curve and they both saw the Shell station, abandoned, with "Repent, Hell is on Earth," painted in white across the windows, which was just as well, Paul reasoned, because the off-ramp was blocked by the mangled hulk of a bus and two other crashed vehicles.
Good shoes,
Artie said in the rear of the truck. Sister dragged her gaze away from the message or warning on the Shell station's windows.
Nothing beats a pair of good, comfortable walking shoes.
He lost his breath and began coughing, and Sister cleaned his mouth with an edge of the blanket. The pickup truck stuttered. Paul felt the blood drain from his face.
Come on, come on.
They just started up a hill. Its top was about a quarter mile away, and if they could make it, they could coast down the other side. Paul leaned forward against the steering wheel, as if to shove the truck the rest of the way. The engine rattled and wheezed, and Paul knew it was about to give up the ghost. The tires kept turning, though, and the truck was still climbing the hill.
Come on, he shouted as the engine caught, sputtered, and then died.
The tires rolled on about 20 yards, getting slower and slower before the truck stopped. Then the tires began to roll backward. Paul plunged his foot on the brake, pulled up the parking brake, and put the gears into first. The truck halted about 100 yards from the hilltop. Silence fell.
That's that, Paul said.
Steve Buchanan was sitting with one hand on the Magnum and the other strangling the scotch bottle's neck.
What now, man? Three choices. We sit here for the rest of our lives, we go back to the cabin, or we start walking ahead.
He took the bottle, got out into the cold wind, and walked around to the tailgate.
Tour's over, friends. We're out of gas.
He snapped a sharp glance at Sister.
You satisfied, lady?
We've still got legs.
Yeah, so do they.
He nodded toward the two wolves that were standing at the edge of the forest, watching intently.
I think they'd beat us in a foot race. Don't you?
How far is it back to the cabin?
Kevin Ramsey asked, his arms around his shivering wife.
Can we make it before dark?
No.
He regarded Sister again.
Lady, I'm one damned fool for letting you talk me into this. I knew the gas stations were going to be shut down.
Then why'd you come?
Because I wanted to believe, even though I knew you were wrong.
He sensed motion to his left, saw three more wolves coming through the wrecks on the eastbound lanes.
We were safe in the cabin. I knew there wasn't anything left.
All the people who passed this way had to be going somewhere, she insisted. You would have sat in that cabin until your ass grew roots.
We should have stayed, Mona Ramsey wailed. Oh, Jesus, we're going to die out here.
Can you stand up? Sister asked Artie. He nodded. Do you think you can walk?
Good shoes, he rasped.
He sat up, pain stitched across his face.
Yeah, I think I can.
She helped him to his feet, then lowered the tailgate and just about lifted Artie to the pavement. He clutched at his side and leaned against the truck. Sister slung the rifle's strap around her shoulder, hefted the duffel bag carefully to the ground, and stepped down from the truck bed. She looked Paul Thorson in the face.
We're going that way, she motioned toward the hilltop. Are you coming with us or staying here?
Her eyes were the color of steel against her sallow, burn-blotched face. Paul realized that she was either the craziest or toughest mother he'd ever met.
There's nothing over there but more nothing.
There's nothing where we came from,
Sister picked up the duffel bag and, with Artie leaning on her shoulder, started walking up the hill.
Give me the rifle, Paul told her. She stopped. The rifle, he repeated. That won't do you a damn bit of good. By the time you get it unslung, you'll be hash. Here,
he offered her the bottle.
Take a long swig. Everybody gets a drink before we start, and for God's sake, keep those blankets around you. Protect your faces as much as you can. Steve, bring the blanket from the front seat. Come on, hurry it up.
Sister drank from the bottle, gave Artie a swallow, and then returned it and the rifle to Paul.
We keep together, he told all of them. We stay in a tight group, just like the wagons when the Indians attacked, right?
He watched the converging wolves for a moment, lifted the rifle, aimed, and shot one through the side. It fell, snapping, and the others leapt upon it, tearing it to pieces.
Okay, Paul said. Let's get on down this damned road.
They began walking, the wind whipping around them in vicious cross-currents. Paul took the lead, and Steve Buchanan brought up the rear. They'd gone no more than 20 feet when a wolf lunged out from behind an overturned car and shot across their path. Paul raised his rifle, but the animal had already found cover beyond another hulk.
Watch our backs, he shouted to Steve.
The animals were coming in from all sides. Steve counted 8, scurrying up from the rear. He eased back the Magnum's hammer, his heart
whacking like a black flag drum beat. Another wolf ran in from the left, a streak of motion headed for Kevin Ramsey. Paul whirled and fired. The bullet sang off the pavement, but the animal turned away. Instantly, two more darted in from the right.
"Look out!"
Sister shouted, and Paul turned in time to shatter a wolf's leg with one slug. The animal danced crazily across the highway before four others dragged it down. He pumped shots at them and hit two, but the rest fled.
"Bullets!"
he called, and Sister dug a handful out of the box he'd given her to carry in her duffel bag. He hastily reloaded, but he'd given his gloves to Mona Ramsey, and his sweaty skin was sticking to the rifle's cold metal. The rest of the bullets went into his coat pocket. They were 70 yards from the top of the hill. Artie leaned heavily on Sister. He coughed blood and staggered, his legs about to fold.
"You can make it," she said. "Come on, keep moving."
"Tired," he said.
He was as hot as a furnace, and he spread warmth to the others gathered around him.
"Oh, I'm so..."
A wolf's head lunged from the open window of a burned Oldsmobile at their side, the jaws snapping at Artie's face. Sister jerked him aside, and the teeth came together with a crack that was almost as loud as Paul's rifle shot a second later. The wolf's head spewed blood and brains, and the beast slithered down into the car.
"Tired,"
Artie finished. Steve watched two wolves racing in from behind. He lifted the Magnum with both hands, his palm slick on the butt, though he was freezing. One of the animals shot off to the side, but the other kept coming. He was just about to fire when it closed within 10 feet, snarled, and ran behind a wrecked Chevy. He could have sworn the snarl had spoken his name. There was motion on his left. He started to turn, but he knew he was too late. He screamed as a wolf shape hit him, knocking his legs out from under him. The Magnum went off, jumping out of his hands and sliding away across the ice. A large silver-gray wolf had Steve's right ankle and started dragging him toward the woods.
"Help me!" he shouted. "Help me!"
The old man acted faster than Paul. He took three running steps, lifted the shortwave radio between his hands, and smashed it down on the wolf's skull. The radio burst apart in a confetti spray of wires and transistors, and the wolf released Steve's ankle. Paul shot it through the ribs, and it too was jumped by three more. Steve limped over to get the Magnum, the old man staring horrified at the metallic mess in his hands. Then Steve guided him back to the group, and the old man let the last of the radio fall. Upwards of 15 wolves were swirling around them, stopping to ravage the dying or wounded. More were coming from the forest. Holy Jesus, Paul thought, as the army of wolves circled them. He took aim at the nearest. A form squirmed out from beneath a car hulk on the side away from his rifle.
"Paul!"
Sister shrieked, and she saw the wolf leap for him before she could do or say anything else. He twisted violently around, but he was hit and knocked down under a clawing, snarling weight. The beast's jaws strained for his throat and clamped shut on the rifle that Paul had thrown up to guard his face. Sister had to let go of Artie to rush the wolf, and she kicked the thing in the side with all her strength. The wolf released Paul's rifle, snapped at her foot, and tensed to spring at her. She saw its eyes, maddened, defiant, like the eyes of Doyle Halland. The wolf leaped. There were two cannon-like explosions, and the bullets from Steve's Magnum almost tore the wolf in half. Sister dodged aside as the wolf sailed past her, its teeth still snapping and its guts trailing behind it. She drew a breath, turned toward Artie, and saw two wolves hit him at once.
"No!"
she shouted as Artie fell. She bashed one of the animals with her duffel bag and knocked it about 8 feet across the pavement. The second chewed on his leg and started dragging him. Mona Ramsey screamed and bolted from the group, running past Steve in the direction they'd come. Steve tried to grab her but missed, and Kevin went after her, caught her around the waist and lifted her off her feet just as a wolf sprang from beneath a wreck and trapped her left foot between its teeth. Kevin and the beast pulled Mona in a deadly tug of war as the woman screamed and thrashed and more wolves ran out of the woods. Steve tried to fire, but he feared hitting the man or woman. He hesitated, cold sweat freezing on his face, and he was still in a trance when a 70-pound wolf hit him in the shoulder like a diesel train. He heard the sound of his shoulder breaking, and he lay writhing in pain as the wolf doubled back and began gnawing at his gun hand. The things were everywhere now, darting in and leaping. Paul fired, missed, had to duck a shape that came flying at his head. Sister swung her duffel bag at the wolf that had Artie's leg, struck its skull, and drove it back. Kevin Ramsey had lost the tug of war. The wolf wrenched Mona out of his grasp and was attacked by another that wanted the same prize. They fought as Mona frantically tried to crawl away. Paul fired and hit a wolf that was about to jump Sister from behind, and then claws were on his shoulders and he was slammed face first into the pavement. The rifle spun away. Three wolves converged on Sister and Artie. The old man was kicking wildly at the animal that was attacking Steve's hand and arm. Sister saw Paul down, his face bleeding, and the beast on top of him trying to claw through his leather jacket. She realized they were less than 10 yards from the top of the hill, and this was where they were going to die. She hauled Artie up like a sack of laundry. The three wolves came in slowly, biding their time. Sister braced herself, ready to swing the duffel bag and kick for all she was worth. Over the snarls and shouts, she heard a deep bass growling noise. She glanced toward the hilltop. The sound was coming from the other side. It must be a horde of wolves racing for their share, she realized, or the monster of all wolves awakened from its lair. "Well, come on," she shouted at the three who were creeping up on her. They hesitated, perhaps puzzled by her defiance, and she felt craziness pulling at her mind again. "Come on, you Its engine growling, a yellow snowplow came over the hilltop. Its treads crunching over debris. Clinging to the outside of the glass-enclosed cab was a man in a hooded green parka, and he was carrying a rifle with a sniper scope. Following behind the plow was a white Jeep like the kind used by postmen. Its driver zipped the vehicle around the wrecks, and another man with a rifle leaned out the Jeep's passenger side, shouting and firing into the air. The man riding shotgun on the snowplow carefully aimed and squeezed off a shot. The middle of the three wolves dropped, and the other two turned tail. The animal on Paul's back looked up, saw the oncoming vehicles, and fled. Another rifle shot sang off the pavement near the two fighting over Mona Ramsey, and they ran for the forest as well. Mona reached her husband and flung her arms around him. The wolf that had made a bloody mess of Steve's arm gave it one last shake and ran as a bullet zipped past its skull. Steve sat up shouting, "Fuckers! You fuckers!" in a high, hysterical voice. The white Jeep skidded to a halt in front of Paul, who was still struggling to get the air back in his lungs. He got to his knees, his jaw and forehead scraped raw and his nose broken, gushing blood. The driver and the man with the rifle stepped out of the postman's Jeep. On the snowplow, the sharpshooter was still popping off bullets at the wolves heading into the woods, and he hit three of them before the highway was cleared of living animals. The Jeep's driver was a tall, ruddy-cheeked man who wore dungarees under a fleece-lined coat. On his head was a cap that advertised Stroh's beer. His dark brown eyes shifted back and forth over the tattered group of survivors. He looked at all the dead and dying wolves, and he grunted. Then he reached work-weathered fingers into a pocket of his dungarees, withdrew something, and offered it to Paul Thorson. "Gum?" he asked. Paul looked at the pack of Wrigley's spearmint and had to laugh. Sister was stunned. She walked past the white Jeep, still bearing Artie's weight on her shoulder. Artie's shoes scraped on the pavement. She walked past the snowplow and reached the top of the hill. Off to the right, through dead trees, smoke was rising from the chimneys of wood-framed houses on the streets of a small village. She saw the steeple of a church. She saw United States Army trucks parked on a softball field, saw a Red Cross banner hanging from the side of a building, saw tents and cars and campers by the thousands scattered in the village streets and through the hills around it. A roadside sign just over the hilltop announced, "Homewood, next exit." Artie's body began to slide to the ground.
"No,"
she said very firmly, and she held him standing with all her strength. She was still holding him up when they came to help her to the white Jeep. Chapter 44. By the light of an oil lamp, Colonel Macklin admired himself in the mirror of the Airstream trailer's bathroom. The gray-green Nazi uniform was a bit tight around the chest and midsection, but the sleeves and trouser legs were long enough. At his waist was a black leather holster and a loaded Luger. On his feet were Nazi hobnailed boots, again, just a bit too small, but Macklin was determined to make them do. Medals and ribbons adorned the uniform's jacket, and though Macklin didn't know what any of them were for, he thought they looked very impressive. The closet in the pigsty of the late Freddie Kempka's bedroom had been full of Nazi uniforms, flak jackets, boots, holsters, and the like. A Nazi flag was fixed to the wall over the bed, and a bookcase held volumes such as The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, Military Strategy and Maneuver, Medieval Warfare, and A History of Torture. Roland had gotten hold of the books and had been devouring them with pure passion. Sheila Fontana slept in the other bedroom, staying mostly to herself except when Macklin needed her. She seemed content to do her duty, though she lay cold and unmoving, and several times Macklin had heard her cry out in the night as if waking up from a dark dream. During the few days they'd occupied the trailer, Macklin had made a thorough inventory of what Freddie Kempka had collected. There was enough junk food and soft drinks to feed an army, plenty of bottled water and canned food as well. But Macklin and Roland were most interested in the weapons. Kempka's bedroom was an arsenal of machine guns, rifles, pistols, a crate of flares, smoke grenades and fragmentation grenades, and boxes and bags and clips of ammunition scattered around like gold in a royal treasure house. The Shadow Soldier didn't have to tell Macklin that he had found paradise. Macklin regarded his face in the mirror. His beard was growing out, but it was so gray it made him look old. Kempka had left a straight razor behind, and Macklin decided he would give himself a shave. Also, his hair was too long and scraggly. He preferred the close-cropped military look. Kempka had also left a pair of scissors that would do the job very well. He leaned forward, staring into his own eyes. They were still deep-sunken and bore the memory of the pain that had ripped through his wound in the Great Salt Lake. A pain so soul-shattering that it had sloughed away the old dead skin that had confined him for so long. He felt new, reborn and alive again, and in his icy blue eyes he saw the Jimbo Macklin that used to be, back in the days when he was young and fast. He knew the Shadow Soldier was proud of him, because he was a whole man again. He did miss his right hand, but he was going to learn how to use a machine gun or a rifle just as effectively with the left. After all, he had all the time in the world. The wound was bound up with strips of bed sheet, and it was still draining, but the heaviness was gone. Macklin knew the salt water had burned the infection out. He thought he looked very handsome, very, yes, kingly, in the Nazi uniform. Maybe it had been a German colonel's uniform, he mused. It was in fine shape, just a few moth holes in the silk lining. Kempka obviously had taken great care of his collection. There seemed to be more lines in his face, but something about that face was wolfish and dangerous. He figured he'd lost 25 pounds or more since the disaster at Earth House. Still, there was just one small thing about his face that bothered him. He lifted his hand and touched what seemed to be a brown scab about the size of a quarter just under his left eye. He tried to peel it off, but it was melded tightly to the skin. On his forehead were four dime-sized scabs that he had at first taken for warts, but those couldn't be peeled off either. Maybe it's skin cancer, he thought.